Hello, it's Brian Tracy speaking.
Hey, Brian, Brendan.
Hello, Brendan. How are you?
Doing great. Great to hear your voice, my friend.
It's great to hear your voice, Brendan. I'm still reeling from that wonderful talk that you gave in Dallas on business and business development. It was really excellent. I took several pages of notes, which I keep on my desk to review.
Oh, wow. Thank you. Well, I appreciate that. That was a good one. It was great seeing you there, my friend.
Oh, it was great
stuff.
That
was so much fun.
You blew everybody away. Well, since this is being recorded and our topic today is becoming a speaker or a seminar leader, let me start off and then I'm going to ask you a little bit about how you got into this business, and then I'll share some of the things that I have learned, and then we'll share the things that we've learned. How's that sound?
That'd be great. I love it.
Well, one of the things that I will often ask my audience, I say, what is the highest paid work in America or anywhere in the world? And people say law, show business, sports, and so on. Well, actually, the answer is professional speaking. And the reason is because a professional speaker, if they get good, which is merely a matter of time if they do the things that we all talk about, if they get good, they can earn several hundred, then several thousand, then several tens of thousands of dollars to speak. People, celebrity speakers, earn consistently $100,000, $150,000 for a 20-minute talk. I've been booked, and I have friends who have been booked for short talks, 10 and 15-minute talks for major audiences, where they're paid $10,000 and $15,000. That's $1,000 a minute. That's real hard money to beat. and so the question is, how do you get into the world of paid professional speaking? So let me ask you, Brendan, for the benefit of the people who are listening, how did you get started? I mean, what was the turning point? I know you started off with Accenture and you started off in consulting, and now suddenly you're one of the best platform speakers and seminar leaders in the country. What was the starting point?
Wow. Well, thank you. You know, my starting point was long before that. I wanted to start speaking when I was 19 years old. You know, I had my car accident, as you know, and that taught me that at the end of our lives, we'll ask these three basic questions of, did I live and did I love and did I matter? And I know we spoke about those on a previous call, but I had that desire to share that message with the world. And to me at the time, it was, well, how do you share a message with the world? And people said, well, you know, you go write a book, and we talked about that already, but then they also say, well, go be a speaker. And I said, well, how do you do that? And they said, I don't know. You know. And I saw that we had a public speaking course in college, and I said, well, enroll in that. So I tried that out, and I was terrified. I mean, I wanted to throw up every time I got up there. But over the course of time, I just became so passionate about sharing that message. And what actually happened, the first paid speech I ever had was a sorority that hired me. I was doing some sort of peer coaching on campus on the topics of relationships. And I coached this girl and her boyfriend on relationships, and did a good enough job that she called the next day. She said, well, I'm the president of the sorority, and we can bring you in to speak. And I said, no, you know, I'm not ready for that. I'm not professional or anything. She says, yeah, but we have a budget of $300. And I said, $300 to come speak? And, you know, back then, my mindset was, that's a lot of beer, because, you know, I was in college. So I said, sure. And I went over there, and what I realized when I did that, Brian, was that these women, as I was speaking, I was terrified. I was totally terrified. But they wanted me to succeed. I could see it in their, as I was talking, I was scared, but I could see them, you know, they wanted to see me succeed because I was up there in front of them. And they wanted to hear my message. And they wanted to improve their lives based on what I was saying. And they were so encouraging. I thought, this is the best. This isn't scary. This is people who are there. They've brought me because I have a very specific expertise in this topic over here that they find valuable. And if I can just go there, they want me to succeed. And now I just have to connect to that message and share that. And I ended up, long story short, paying for grad school by speaking to sororities and fraternities on the topics of relationships and leadership. And then, so by the time I got to Accenture, I'd honed some speaking skills. And those speaking skills, I know, which we'll talk about later, helped me go from, you know, just beginning at Accenture, but within a couple years, they put me on partner path because they thought, this kid can communicate. And I think the person who can communicate the best in a room is always the person who's going to move up and advance the furthest. And suddenly I started moving forward, and then more schools started calling me, and then corporations started calling me. And what happened is exactly what you're saying, which is this part of my life started compensating better than my regular job. And I started realizing that I had more passion for it, and it was more engaging and allowed me to express myself in the world more fully than the traditional job that I had. And so I left and I started this full time.
Wonderful. Now, let's talk about this with regard to the people who are listening who have thought about getting into speaking but don't even know where to start. Let me give them my background. I started off in sales as a young man, and I struggled, and I finally learned how to sell. I asked the top people, I read the books, I listened to the programs, I developed a sales system, and I was so successful that they encouraged me to recruit other people. At that time, you could recruit people at a lower commission level than yourself and earn the difference between your level of commission based on your volume of sales and their level of sales. So I was earning 6 or 7%. I could recruit people who were earning 3.5 or 4%. And as they moved up, as their volume moved up, the difference that I was earning, the override, would shrink, but it would be on a bigger volume. So anyway, so I began to recruit people, and then I recruited several people, and then I realized I had to train them. But rather than one at a time, I trained them in small groups and then larger groups. And basically what I did was I just explained to them the things that I had done that enabled me to be successful. And I'm happy to say, in retrospect, going back years later, many of those people are millionaires and multimillionaires, and they own large companies and multiple businesses and so on. And they say the turning point came from learning how to sell. Well, that's the key, is to talk about something that you really know about and that you really care about, and that you really care about the people who are listening learn from you. And, of course, I was motivated because the more successful I could make them, the more sales they would make and the more money I would make. So, and then afterwards, I got speaking in politics, and I got very excited about the free market and private property and opportunity and liberty and free enterprise. And so I studied it voraciously, and then I would share people and talk to people about how wonderful a system this was and how good it was and how many opportunities it made possible. So in retrospect, what I found is that my success as a speaker was because I spoke about something that I really knew about because I'd done a lot of reading, research, and experience. And I really cared about it, and I really cared about conveying it to my audience. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, I think that's everything. And people get so worked up in all the technicalities of, you know, telling a great story or being a great speaker and all these other things. And at the end of the day, you just gave them the million-dollar piece of advice, which is you cared about it, and you cared about them so much. I got hired one time. I don't know if I ever told you a story. This I was doing pretty well on platforms and making offers on platforms. So I'd get up and I'd, you know, teach for 80 minutes, and then the last 10 minutes I'd offer something for sale. And you know, my reputation was gaining in that area, and this pretty well-known speaker said, "Hey, could you come out and watch my platform presentation and teach me how I can sell more?" And he sold something at the $3,000 level. So he said, "I'll give you $50,000 if you can come out and you can tell me how to do better at that." And at the time, I thought, that's unbelievable, because that's $50,000 for 90 minutes of work. Sure, I'll come listen to you and tell you what to do, you know?
Right.
And so I thought, okay, and I have my little checklist of what makes a good speech and everything. So I went out there and I sat down, and this guy was a pro. He was very talented. He was very good. And at the end, he says, "Okay, just, you know what, I just tell me the one thing I have to do." And I said, "You know, the one thing that you have to do is right now, because you speak so intelligently and you're so smart and you're so engaging with people, too, that you have some flippant humor in there, that you're coming across in a way that the audience can't actually tell whether or not you care about them. And if they can't sense and actually emotively feel that you care about them, then we're in trouble. So all we have to do is we have to change some of your tonality. We've just got to change some of the stories that you use and the directive things that you say to the audience. So they say, wow, this person really gives a damn if I get it or not." And that was his challenge. They couldn't tell if he cared, if they got it. It wasn't that he couldn't tell, is he a caring person? And there's a huge difference between the two. It's not, are you a caring person? Of course you are. You're up on stage. But do you care if they understand and apply the concepts you are teaching? And I think that what you said to me really reminded me of that story, because here's a very professional speaker, but he can't succeed because he can't demonstrate that he cares so much. And I honestly think, I mean, I've been following your work forever, and you changed my life when I was a young man, when I was listening to your CDs and tapes back when I began. And I know that one of the reasons I continue to follow you is because as a speaker and as a trainer, you really care. And you're willing to get under our feathers and tease us and goad us and make sure and look at us like, you understand? And even when you and I talk one-on-one at like a dinner, you'll say something, and you teach sometimes, Brian, I notice you'll look at me in a way that is checking to see if I got it. And I've always appreciated that about you, and I honestly think that's one of the reasons you're the world's best.
Well, thank you so much. I have always felt that it's really the emotional thing. And when I began speaking, I was so preoccupied with content. And I carried myself with content for a long time. People were amazed at the quality and value of the content. And then I got a speaking coach. After speaking for 10 years, I got a speaking coach, Ron Arden, who passed away recently, one of the best, probably the best speaking coach in America. And I worked with him for 15 years. As a matter of fact, he spent the afternoon at my home last year, last time I saw him. And we even wrote a book together called The Power of Charm. And he said, Brian, he said, you don't need to have so much content. He said, they don't know what you leave out. You don't have to have this obsession for giving them more and more and more and more. They don't know what you leave out. And then Og Mandino, when he was alive, after I'd given a speech, I'd been given 1 hour to give a speech that I usually did for half a day. And so I compressed it into 1 hour, and it was just too fast. And he said to me, Brian, he took me aside, he said, Brian, he said, are you open to a little bit of feedback? And I said, absolutely. You know, Og was one of the most popular writers and speakers in the nation at that time. He said, Brian, he said, very slowly, he said, you've got to romance your points a little bit more. Mm. And I said, what? He said, you've got to romance your points. He said, take the point and then romance it. Tell a little story about it. Give an example. Use a little bit of humor. And that was a turning point in my life, Brendan, is romance your points, and they don't know what you leave out. Because it is in the romancing, in the telling the story and what it meant to you and giving examples from your life and that of others, that the whole talk comes alive. So that was very helpful.
That's so true. I love that. I love that. I think people, you know, these days they want to teach everything they know when they have the opportunity to do it, but you know, the formats are getting shorter and shorter. You know, the TED talk is what, 16 minutes, you know, and videos, you know, YouTube originally had them default at 10 minutes long. Luckily they opened that and you can do longer. And, but you know, I think that people's, as you're beginning, you want to teach everything. Well, I just did that speech you opened with that you referenced that we did in Dallas, that I got to do in Dallas for the group. That was, I had 3 points. I wrote 3 points on the, remember I had 3 flip charts up on stage.
Right.
Each flip chart had one phrase on it.
Yes.
And I just filled in the blank as I went along, and I'd tell stories along it and back it up. I always say it's like teach a strategy to people as far as what they should do, and then bolster it with an illustrative story to help it stick. Bolster it with some data and facts and counterintuitive arguments that make them really think, and bolster it some with some humor, which I'm not as good as. You know, I look funny, but I'm not funny. So you've always been good at that. You've got the one-liners so good that you know, I know I need to work on that personally. But I love that you that you really mention that to people, because you don't have to teach everything. What people want, I believe, on the stage is they just want to know. I've been referring them all year as the needle movers. They just want to know what's going to move the needle for me. I don't need to know everything. just tell me the things that's going to move the dial for me, move the needle for me in terms of my happiness or my success or my ability to achieve in the specific area. And so what I always try to do is I focus on those needle movers, and I only hit those and only emphasize those. And part of that for me is positioning in my belief about becoming a world's greatest speaker, you know, is if people are always seeing you give that caliber of content that's not the fluff stuff but the stuff that moves the needle for them, then they're more likely to, you know, refer you, book you, share the message with you. So I try not to speak to the common denominator in the room, but rather to the sort of the advanced strategy that's going to move the needle for people.
You know, that's really good. It's interesting. Lisa Sasevich has a wonderful approach to everything she does. She says that what people want more than anything else is transformation. Mm. They want to know that after they have worked with you, listened to you, come to your seminar, they will be transformed to a different place, that they will be different in themselves. And we could talk all about the psychology and research of that, but it's just a wonderful, simple concept. The other thing that I have taught for years in selling is that people only buy one thing. Going back to the first open markets in ancient Sumeria 6,000 years ago, people only buy one thing, and that is they buy improvement. They buy improvement. Is they buy the product or service because they feel that it will improve their life in some way. And the greater the potential improvement, the greater value it is in bringing about transformation. And Charlie Cook, who's a really wonderful marketer, says that people only buy one thing. He says they buy hope. Every product or service is merely hope. And I think of those three concepts, transformation, improvement, hope. So we buy something because we hope it will improve our lives and bring about a transformation in our results. And there you have it. So that's what speaking is, because speaking in a way is a product. It is a product. You're delivering a product that Ralph Waldo Emerson said the essence of all good speaking is that it motivates people to take an action that they would not have taken in the absence of the speech.
I love that. Yeah, I love that. And I think today, with so much competition, it's really important that, you know, as people are forming their speeches, they sit down and they write these words down that you're talking about, the transformation and the hope and taking the action and this idea of needle movers, because, you know, it's the great part about our industry is anyone can become a speaker. And
yes.
The challenging part about succeeding in the industry is that anybody can become a speaker. You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, you and I have both seen, you know, I've been sort of paid to speak since I've been 19 because of that college experience, and then my corporate experience. And as a full-time person doing this, only, you know, this is only my sixth year. I know you've done a little more than that. But in the amount of time, I've certainly seen a lot of people come and go because, you know, they have the hot new story. You know, they survived some dramatic thing, or they've got some, you know, media story that picks up that's amazing, and they get booked for a little while, but they can't make it a career, and they kind of come and go. But the ones who stick, I think, really do focus on they stick because they care so much about the message and the audiences, and then they have just these little elements that are in that keep getting them rebooked of really moving the needle for that audience. That when you finish, it's not just about the standing ovation. It's about the marching out the door to go do something new that I think gets your name around the business.
Yes. Well, you know, when I first started, I started from a business background, and I took a strategic approach. And my strategic approach is how do I want to be thought of by my audience? And my answer was high content, high energy. That was 30 years ago, Brandon, and it's never changed. It's still high content, high energy. I want people, because I've seen speakers, as you have, who are very high energy and no content.
Right.
they're all over the place. But at the end of the day, you say, what did you get? I remember a speaker who was very popular for a while, And I was invited to, corporation invited me to come and listen to him speak. So I use what I call the note test. And the note test is I keep notes of everything I think of that's valuable. I've studied and taught super learning. And what I found is that people who take the best notes also retain the most material. People who take poor notes or no notes at all retain nothing. I just read a study yesterday based on work at UCLA that if you listen to a seminar without taking notes, you'll forget 90% within 30 days, sometimes within 30 minutes. Whereas if you take notes and you review your notes once immediately after the seminar, once later on at the end of the day, once in 3 days, once in 3 weeks, once in 3 months, you'll remember 90%.
Yeah.
So people who take good notes really learn a lot. So when I structure my talks, I structure them all so that there is, I called it, I'm getting off track, but not really, I call it spine and ribs. The spine are the key points, and the ribs are the romancing, the stories, the examples. So, but I always have a spine, and so that when I'm going from point one to point two to point three, many times, for example, if you're speaking a short talk, you have three key points. Like your talk, you had three key points, and you had 3 hours. And what you did is those were the three vertebrae, and then what you did is you gave all of the side parts on each of those, and then came back to point number two, and then gave all of the side points and examples and illustrations and so on, and back to point two. But I took several pages of notes.
Yeah.
So even though you had 3 points that were really reinforced by a lot of information. And so I said, and I remember going to the speaker, and I walked out after 3 hours of listening to this person talk and tell stories and jokes and humor and everything else. I had 3 notes, and one of them was what I was going to do for lunch. And you know what? He eventually died away. People just eventually stopped booking him. They said, okay, the worst thing I ever heard about a speaker is, are you going to hear this speaker tonight? No, I've heard him before.
Oh, yeah.
I've already heard him. In other words, he's got one song. He sings the one song, and it's the same song. And they say it's easier to get a new audience than a new talk, so they never upgrade their material.
Well, I think I love what you said, too, because I think part of these calls we're doing here are, you know, what makes people successful along these lines of being an expert and getting their message out there and being in our industry. And I think one of the aspects of what you just said is really amazing. I've been so blessed to get to know you and some of the other people who really did move the needle for me and change my life, and they all had that same thing in common with the notes. I remember the first time I sat down with Jack Canfield, and I watched him. He was the most ferocious note taker I'd ever seen.
Yes.
Just everything. I mean, just ferocious about it. I mean, it was unbelievable. And then the first time I sat down with Tony Robbins, and he, literally, and you do the same, it's like you're enraptured in the note-taking process.
Right.
And I'll never forget that, because it was like, it was just every single time it surprised me. I'm like, wow, okay, I got to take some more notes over here. I start taking some notes, and I've been an avid note taker all my life, and I actually have all my shelves full of all these little black books that I've filled with notes, and I go back to them, and I review them, and I spend time with them, because I want to solidify that, and I think that's really key in a couple things. One, knowing that if note-taking is a success principle, then that's important to know. And then the other part about it is to structure your speech so that you can give people you can give them the spine and the ribs, and also give them the one-liners that I actually, when I spoke at your Total Business Mastery program, I remember watching you on stage, and then when you came out to Experts Academy one time too, watching you on stage, and the notes, so many of the notes that I would take were these great, just one line. I'm sure you prepared for them, or you know them, or you've practiced them, or some of them they're part of your own internal genius, but you'd say these one sentences that were so strong, and I was like, I got to write that down. And it's these takeaway sentences that really makes you a memorable speaker sometimes, because people walk out in the hallway and they might not remember all the points, but they're just like, boy, when he said this one sentence, and they're like, yeah, that sentence. And as a speaker, you get to learn and watch. You should actively watch your audience to see what's making their eyes drop off of you and onto the page and take a note.
Yes.
Like, I'm always really tempted. I'm like, what is that? Like, one of the things I used to always say that I didn't know was a big deal, but I noticed the audience would just go nuts when I said this. I said, never let your small business make you small-minded.
Right.
And people would just, bam, they'd write that out. And, I mean, the whole audience would turn down and write that. I thought, oh, that's weird. They all just wrote that down. So it'd remind me to always say that in my videos or when I'm talking about that specific topic. And it still gets them to this day. And when I talk about productivity and I talk about the inbox, I often say, you know, be careful. The inbox is nothing but a convenient organizing system for other people's agendas. Everyone loves that because everyone hates their inbox.
Yes.
And so, you know, you think about what is it in your audience that they either hate or that they aspire to, and how can you sum that up in a sentence that can have some legs? And, you know, that's all over the internet. It's been quoted on that inbox thing with me. And, it again, it helps it stick, and it helps the takeaway, and it helps give people a note to take down and something to talk about in the hallways. And all that's just part of the magic of what we do.
Yeah. The key is wanting to help, and people realize you're here to help. Now, I like to just bridge into a couple of things which I teach in my speaking academy and you teach in your Experts Academy with regard to speaking. If you want to be a speaker, the first question I ask people before I explain to them the basic structure of a talk is the first thing I ask is, why do you want to speak well? And the second question is, what kind of speaking do you want to do? Again, taking a strategic point of view is very, very helpful. So I've written down about 7 reasons why people want to speak. My friend Bill Gove, when he was alive, I think he was perhaps the best speaker in America, just funny and engaging. And people would come up to him for years and years and years and ask him, tell him, I want to be a speaker. I want to be a successful speaker. I want to be a speaker. And he would say, why? Why do you want to be a speaker? And often they would just be flat-faced. They would have no idea. Well, I want to be a speaker because I want to be famous. Do you know that 68% of teenagers today, their goal is to grow up and be famous?
I know. I saw that stat.
Oh, it's absolutely unbelievable. They want to get on American Idol. They want to. Yeah. The ones, they can't sing, they can't talk, they can't do anything. but they think that the key to their success is going to somehow become famous for nothing. Anyway, so what I did is I wrote down some of the reasons why people want to be successful, want to speak well, and I want our listeners to think to themselves, which of these do you want? So let me just tell you what they are. Number one, people want to speak because they want to make a lot of money. And I've always been amazed at this. I want to make a lot of money. I want to make a lot of money. And they don't understand that in terms of mastery, it takes 7 years of learning your craft, really hard work on your craft and on your subject before you really start to get paid well. And they're really shocked at that. They thought, well, all you have to do is start giving talks and you get $5,000 a talk. I had somebody call me up who worked for the government and said he's decided to leave the government and get into speaking, and he'd like me to book him at $5,000 a time. Could I give him some dates? I said, why on earth would I book you? He said, well, I want to speak. I said, where did you get the $5,000 number? He said, well, that's what speakers get. They get $5,000. And I learned later through secret industry statistics that 90% of speakers earn $500 a day or less for a full day.
Yeah, I bet that's true.
Yeah, for 90%. There's only a tiny 1% or 2% that actually earn big money. So they say, I want to make a lot of money. And what Bill Gove would say is that is not enough of a reason to want to be a speaker. It's just not enough of a reason.
I agree. And, you know, I think the other part about that, too, it cues for me is, you know, obviously what you're teaching so much and I'm teaching is the positioning that people can learn, you know, the promotional strategies and the credibility strategy and the positioning strategies to get hired as a speaker and get paid more. But my emphasis to so many people is like, hey, this is a career. And just like a career in corporate America, when you join a new company, when you go to that company, you look at, you know, what's often called your skill ladder or, you know, your development plan, and you say, okay, what are the, you know, knowledge, skills, and abilities and competencies I'm going to have to build as I go along my career here to move up the ladder here so I can get paid more, so I can succeed more. And what happens is people come into our industry and they want to become the CEO tomorrow.
Yeah.
They want to, you know, they're not thinking like this is a career. I've always approached this as a career. I said when I decided to leave my other career and I started this career, and I did. I had the blessing of working for, you know, it was a Fortune 500 company, the largest consulting company in the world, and 200,000 plus employees. So they really figured out the development plan for their people. And they said, okay, if you're an analyst, you got to learn these three things. You're going to go through these, you know, four core courses. And if you're a consultant, you're going to go through these. And if you're a manager, these, and senior manager, and so on. Well, I learned very quickly that when I came in this industry, I said, okay, what am I going to have to learn here and develop some competency at in order to move up in terms of positioning and pay? And I really thought about it. And people should do that with the speaking career, too. They should say, okay, what am I really going to have to master here? Well, I'm going to have to master the art of storytelling and content development. I'm going to have to master the art of presentation and physicality. I'm going to have to master the art of persuasion. I'm going to have to master the art of rapport. I'm going to have to master the art of, you know, of marketing so that I can market myself out there. I'm going to have to master the art today of doing video because no one's going to hire you unless they see a video of you speaking. And not just a promotional reel. They need to see a real video of you killing it. And they want to see it on a public site like a YouTube or a Facebook or something like that.
Yes.
And so you've got to develop that. And it's not easy for people. And, you know, people want to come and do, you know, in my world, they want to come and do an online video launch and make $1 million. And I say, well, you know, have you ever given a presentation to videos? Oh, no, not yet, but I'll get that. And I say, no, it's a skill. What are the skills you have to learn in order to advance in your career? Figure those skills out and then work like a dog to develop those skills and practice those skills and hone those skills. And I agree with what you say. That's a 7-year process. You know, mastery and expertise in terms of the unconscious competence at that.
Yes.
That is a 10-year journey. You know, I think you can become very proficient at something very fast because, like you, I believe in super learning. And I believe that, you know, I can master something and pick something up through modeling and deep study. And I can pick something up and I can be rocking at a professional level on it, I really believe, within a year. And yet, to have real mastery and be at the top levels of pay and positioning and to be so good at it that it is more natural because it's unconscious competence. That's the areas of expertise and mastery that, you know, everyone has talked about with that 10,000 hours mark, you know, a decade.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I began using a measure when I was a younger speaker, and that's hours on your feet in front of an audience. There's an expression in National Speakers Association called stage time. How much stage time? Go for more stage time because nothing replaces being on your feet in front of a critical public audience. So how many hours do you have? And I say it takes 1,000 hours to learn how to speak. It takes 2,000 hours to learn if you should be in this business. It takes 3,000 hours before you start to earn money. It takes 4,000 hours in front of an audience before you start to make good money. It takes 5,000 hours till you start to make excellent money. And and every hour of speaking has to be backed up and reinforced by 3 to 10 hours of study and preparation. And so it's always hours on your feet. And when you look at somebody who's really, really good on their feet, you say, this didn't happen overnight. This person has got years and years and thousands of hours of speaking to every kind of audience and having every kind of experience before they got to this level of quality.
Yeah, and that willingness to struggle through is, I honestly, that I really believe that the engagement and the willingness and the sheer, yeah, joy that you take in the struggle to get better at something, that to me is a definitive hallmark of what makes someone successful.
You know, there's a wonderful line. I picked it up in Italy. It's from St. Francis of Assisi. He said, "It's heaven all the way to heaven, and it's hell all the way to hell." And so if you're in speaking for the right reasons, then all experiences are good because you enjoy it. You just they say that with regard to writing, a true writer is someone who cannot not write. Well, a true speaker, in my estimation, is someone who cannot not speak about their subject. Mm-hmm. They just love the subject so much. So they'll speak to small audiences, and they'll speak to free audiences, and they'll speak to large audiences, and they'll just speak all the time on their subject because they just love the subject, and they love how the subject can help people if they understand it.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely, and that's so good. They love to see it, how it helps people, and I don't know what I would do if it wasn't this. And I think that's a good thing for people to think about: is what would you do if it wasn't speaking? And if you really kind of befawn, you're not sure. Not that you couldn't have other options, but it's a passion thing. It would be like taking the art away from the artist. And that's the way I feel about it. This is my art. I think it's not only one of the highest compensating industries. I think it's one of the highest fulfillment industries, because the act of creative expression and contribution is what this uniquely gives us. And those are two of our primary human drives. You know, to be able to express thyself and to be able to contribute to others is so fully ingrained in our human DNA.
Right.
And people sense that. When people think about starting this business, Brian, how do you think of it? Because you think of it as a business like I do. If someone's going to, quote-unquote, start the business of speaking, what would you recommend they do?
Well, let me just go back a second and just cover the other reasons for wanting to speak well, and then we'll jump ahead.
Okay.
The first one was you want to make a lot of money, which is must be prepared to spend 7 to 10 years working at it. Number two, you want to be a celebrity, and that is, again, a shallow reason. There are many speakers, and I know them, who make $300,000-$500,000 a year, live in beautiful homes in beautiful neighborhoods, live wonderful lives. You've never heard of them. They don't need to be celebrities, but in the subjects that they speak on, in the industries that they speak, I was speaking to a gentleman the other day who does 170 talks a year at $10,000 to $15,000 a talk, and he speaks on occupational health and safety to mining companies. And he's fully booked. And every mining and resource extraction company in the country wants him to come and speak about safety and safety procedures to their people so that they can create a safer environment and have and reduce the number of injuries that people have. You've never heard of this guy, and the guy will make more than $2 million this year.
That's awesome.
Why? He doesn't want to be a celebrity. He doesn't even care. He doesn't even want to make a lot of money, but he really wants to help people protect themselves. So that's the third one. The third one is you want people to like and respect you. And this is okay. This is normal and healthy unless you have such deep needs for the reinforcement of others that you are speaking almost begging for them to like you. You know, like Sally Fields, they like me. They really like me.
Right.
Again, this is not a good reason, but here's the fourth one, is you want to help people in some way. And what you've said several times is that we are helpers, is we see ourselves, our job is to help people improve their lives by sharing not only our background and experience, but the specific things that they can do. And so we are teachers more than anything else. And I think the most successful speakers, aside from the great motivators like Zig Ziglar and Les Brown, aside from the great motivators, they're teachers. And they believe so passionately in what they're teaching that they teach it with great conviction and enthusiasm, and they dress it up with fun and humor and stories.
Agreed. I think about the some of those folks you just mentioned and the best speakers I ever saw, they did that. And I love that. You know, it was one of the words I wanted to say, too, on this line, which was conviction. You know, you've got to have a lot of conviction and a lot of confidence. You got to have supreme confidence in yourself and your ability to move the needle for the audience. And you got to have absolute conviction for the words and the messages that come out of your mouth. And I think that's so important because so many here's what I fear is happening in the speaking industry a little bit. And you see more than I do, so you can echo off of this. But there's it's sort of the Silicon Valley creep into speaking, professional speaking, which is, you know, in Silicon Valley right now, and in a lot of the corporate cool marketing world, what's cool is the guy who comes up there in, you know, jeans and a T-shirt, and he's super laid back, and he don't care, you know. he's just I'm a cool web guy, and, you know, I got my jeans and my hoodie on, and is so casual about their message, it almost comes across as like, yeah, you sense that they're a cool person. And it's cool to listen for them because they own some .com that's making millions or something.
Yes.
But I fear that that style is creeping into the lexicon of the professional speaking world, and I don't think that it needs to, and I actually think it's not a good thing. I think that that level of casualness, well, I think it's important to be approachable and casual and friendly and likable on stage. I think that that casual, cool thing is actually not good because it doesn't, there's not enough conviction to emotionally charge the audience to taking a new action. There's not enough conviction in the message that they sense that you care so much about your thing and your message that they're now also going to care about your thing and your message in their own lives. And I think you've got to amp yourself up and you've got to amp your message out there and you've got to make it count because that casual, cool thing, while we, you know, we all think, oh, that's so neat, I don't think that those people are changing people's lives as much, and I think that the casualness pulls away from the professionalism that gets people booked over and over.
I absolutely agree with you. I see these people. I remember seeing Scott McAneely speak when he was the president of Sun Microsystems before it collapsed and was taken over, and he was so arrogant. He was dressed in a pair of jeans, speaking to a Fortune 500 audience in Texas, a pair of jeans, a casual open-neck shirt, Sebi-shaven, moccasins, and he was speaking as though he was the king of the world, no preparation. He just got up there and he just blew shot his mouth off because I'm so big, I'm so smart, I'm so rich and everything else. And I looked at that and I've seen so much of that and I just, you know, I said, jerk. This guy's just a rich jerk. And you know, when the money goes, you know what they say? Your phone never rings again. When you're no longer the rich jerk, you're just a jerk. So I agree with you. I people say, well, you know, we're going to be doing our national convention is going to be in a resort, and so you can dress casually because everybody will be dressed casually. I always dress perfectly for a professional audience. I always wear tailored suits, tailored shirts, silk ties. Always professionally prepared, always go over the material, always stay on time. If you respect your craft, that's what you do. Who would want, if they needed surgery, who would want a casual surgeon who shows up looking like they just fell off a watermelon truck, unshaven, dirty, late, hair unkempt and everything else? I'll tell you, when I had surgery on my shoulder, it was a great comfort to see the surgeon show up as sharp as a razor blade, ready to go, eyes piercing, penetrating, wide awake, alert. And he did brilliant surgery. I mean, he just did brilliant surgery on my shoulder. And I to this day, I say, I love to work with professionals. And that's where the future is in this business. There's a present for casualness, but the future is to be a professional.
Yeah, I agree. And professionals, they you know, you and I talk about it. It's just a simple phrase, but professionals prepare.
Yeah.
And, you know, you and I can both stand on a stage, and you and I could both, you know, we could go days by now pretty comfortably and just speak it just off the top, just going for days. But we don't. We still prepare, and we still think it through, and we still bend our mind to make it better, and that's what makes it go. And I think that especially the easiest thing to do is to develop the skill now and then back away from developing it further to go, well, I know how to do this. I got it. And I think that what makes a professional is they're always pushing themselves to make something excellent. And if you've got 10 minutes in front of an audience, or you've got a day or an hour, that's the time to say, wow, what – and just bend your mind the couple days before and practicing to figure out what is it that's going to really, really move the needle for this audience, and what's going to be so incredible, and make it that way. Because I'm out there too, and I'm just on so many stages these days, especially in that sort of Silicon Valley-esque world right now, because of my marketing expertise, that, you know, these guys come in, they're so flippant on stage, and they're so casual, and they get the nice golf claps at the end, but they're not getting standing ovations, and they're not actually changing people's emotive or mental states.
Yep.
And I think when you start to take it seriously, that I'm going to change this audience's emotional and mental state, and they're going to walk out of here charged. They're going to walk out of here knowing what to go do, knowing what to focus on, and committed to doing that, then you have changed them, and it will change your career too.
Yep. There's two other reasons why people want to speak, and I think this describes you. I call number four, you want to help people in some way, and number five, you want to share your experiences to change people for the better.
Yeah. That's good.
Because that really describes you. You want to help people, and me too, and you want to share your experiences to change people for the better. I have a thing about people's experiences. I believe that they are springboards. You use your experience, because everyone has had a difficult experience in their life, which was a transition point, which led them to understand things at a better and higher level. Many people actually get up on the stage, and I've seen this so many times, by people who have never been seen again, and all they do for the whole time they're there, they're supposed to say, I'm going to be talking about how you can dramatically improve your communication style in your business and be more influential. So they get up there and they tell their story of tragedy, and they have 1 hour to talk, and they tell their story of tragedy for 55 minutes. And all you hear is me, 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 my story, me, me, me. And what they're doing is they're using their talk as a form of group catharsis or group psychotherapy.
That's right.
Please listen to me. Let me expiate my demons. Let me tell you about it. And they find that once people will listen, because people are interested in other people's stories, but they never get booked again. Who ever wants to hear your story of woe again? So I have a good friend. Give you a wonderful example. I have a good friend, Charlie Plum. Charlie Plum was shot down over Vietnam and served 6.5 years in the Hanoi Hilton, the prison camp in North Vietnam, where he was locked in a cell, and they had limited communication, and they communicated with others by tapping on the side. And he had a small cell, maybe 6x8 or 6x10, one bunk, and that's it. Well, when he speaks, when he came back, he was asked to speak on his topic, so he did, and he was asked again, and he did. And then what he did is he started to use his experience as a springboard. And what he did is he would get up, and I saw him do this, he'd get up on the stage in front of a business, and a business audience, especially a corporation, and then he would have two chairs with the backs facing in, about 8 feet apart. And then he would stand on the stage, and then he would start pacing back and forth between the two chairs. That's what he just paced and turned around and came back and paced. And he did this for about a minute or two at the beginning of his talk. Never said a word, just paced. And then he would stop again in the middle. He said, this was the size of my cell for 6.5 years in North Vietnamese prison camp. He said, and that's all I could move, back and forth, back and forth. But I needed to keep fit. He said, but everybody is in a cell of their own making. Everybody is in a cell that's sometimes determined by others. And it could be the cell of competition and reduced prices and the market that you're facing today. And he would immediately bridge into the company, which he'd done all his research on, and talk about how you need to break out and you need to think outside the box and you need to be optimistic and you need to look. And he would just use his experience as a springboard and not go back to it. And whereas other people that I've spoken to who were actually prisoners of war, they would give their story of their being a prisoner of war for the whole time, forever.
Yeah.
That's all they ever talked about was me, 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 and my story. And Charlie Plum has been booked 100 times a year for 25 years, or 35 years, at very, very good rates, and he lives in a beautiful mansion and everything else. So it's wonderful to have a story, like your story, my story, but then to use the story to help the people in the audience. It's just simply a device to help them, saying, this is where I came from, and this is what the decisions that I made that got me here, and you can do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And when the light goes on, goes on in someone's home, it goes on, like, I can do this, I can do that, I can be this, I can be that, I can make changes in my life, I can transform myself. That gives them hope, it gives them inspiration, it gives them guidance, and then you start to fill in. So this is what you do. You do this, and you do this, and you do this, and you do this. And it gives them confidence at the top, and then it gives them competence at the bottom. So they walk out thinking, I can do this. I can change my life. I can be better. I can be stronger. I can be faster. And it's wise because you connected with them with your story, and then you told them what to do.
I love that. You know, there was, I'm trying to remember where I read this recent piece about the development of memoirs and how memoirs have changed over the last decades. And this is really interesting, and it has a lot to do with what we're sharing about, which is they did a literary analysis of the stories that were being shared and the perspectives that were being shared in memoirs over the last decades. And what they found is over the last 3 decades, there's been this tidal shift of memoirs starting to be, they didn't use this phrase, but I was sort of belly button gazing, that all these memoirs were, now memoirs are these very detailed descriptions of all the wrongs and tragedies these people have faced. They're very detailed descriptions of how their parents have wronged them and how these parents who have wronged them in this specific situation led to a bad life. And they're very, that the development of the American awarded literary piece in memoirs now are all about stories in which a person takes this thing that happens to them and they blow it up and they really go on and on about it and they extract every little nuance and every little detail out of the story. I mean, to what was on the table and on the floor at the time or how the person sounded or what they smelled like, and they go way into the detail. I mean, super descriptive detail.
Yeah.
About these tragedies and these trials. And they said the interesting thing was that didn't used to be the case, especially if you jump back a century ago. What the memoir was more of a commentary about, it wasn't about these minute little things. It was more of a progression, a journey of their overall life in the context and commentary of society and culture and the world. In other words, it was a much more worldly, thoughtful perspective about their own place in the world. But now, with the Facebook generation we have right now, everything's me, 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 me. And it's the same challenge, I think, in our industry that we're going to face of that casual cool is out there. But then all of this belly-gazing, my story, my story, my story, me, 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 like you were just sharing, that those two things together, I think, are... We really have to, we've got to go the other way. That's one of the things where I say, do not follow culture. You know, don't try to be hip with culture, because hip with culture right now is casual cool and talking about me, 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 here's my journey, my journey, my journey. Same way I see these CEOs of these major.coms who are just like, oh, here's my story, my story, my story, my story. And they just tell their story on stage and they can't get to the place where they're actually contributing value to the audience.
Well, it's interesting. I keep telling people in my coaching programs, it's not about you. It's not about you. It's about them. It's about them. Whenever I talk, by the way, I always talk about you. You use the same thing. You always refer to you. The people in the audience are you. One of the definitions of speaking is enthusiastic conversation, where you're speaking to one person. So even though there's a large audience, you're speaking to each individual in the audience. You're not a preacher preaching to the flock. You're speaking one person at a time. Like I call it the sniper model, one shot, one kill. Is you're speaking to each individual. So I always say you have had this experience, and maybe you have felt, have you ever thought of doing this? It's always you, and you use that same style.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think people want that, and they want that in the context of who you are and who they are and who we are as a group. And I think that's one of the other elements, too, of what I got from that memoir study, which was also about it's not just about us and you, it's about that big we story too. And I see that you do that with groups, and I try to do that with my groups too, which is if I always trying to connect the group, the audience I'm in with what I call a higher movement, which is challenging this group that we're with to be part of a special new group that's advancing society or bringing back some type of lost value in society. And I challenge the group, literally challenge them with that, with a tone that says we can do better and that we must lead the way. We have to bring back character. We must bring back integrity. We must be, and what I do is I challenge them to be part of almost a subversive new movement to bring back something that we all know is important and valued.
Yes.
And so it's my story, then it's them, you, and then it's we, and our collective story moving forward. You do this, I love it, because you always say, look, we're going to leave here as the top 1% in the world who knows how to do this. And that brings responsibility. I love how you do that. And I think that's another master craft of being a great artist up on stage, is being able to unite the group in something common that raises them outside of themselves.
Absolutely. Now, as we're approaching the last 2 or 3 minutes here, there's a couple of points that I think it's really important to make. And this is my focal point, is that all business skills are learnable. All speaking skills are learnable. Mm. That this is a craft. If you can drive a car, if you can type with a keyboard, if you can use a modern cell phone, you can learn to become an excellent speaker. And you have to approach it seriously, as you did, learning all the different parts of the craft, and then you just have to practice and practice. How do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice. But for those who are listening, they have to understand that everyone starts off as a poor speaker. Even if you can... If you have an enthusiastic personality, and some of the best speakers of all are very dry, they're very calm, they're very relaxed, they're not loud at all, and they're absolutely brilliant. So you don't have to have an exciting, dynamic personality to become a really excellent speaker and really persuade and influence people.
Mm. I agree. Yeah, it's not about charisma. In terms of the traditional model of jumping around like a clown on stage, it's about conviction, about believing deeply in something and having value to add to the audience. But I agree with what you're saying. This is a learnable skill that is just like all other skills, that it gets better the more it's utilized in different contexts.
Yes.
And so the more that you utilize this, as Brian was saying, and you get those hours, and you log in the hours, and the unconscious competence starts to come into play, but you still stay on top of yourself and demand that level of excellence and presence and thoughtfulness with that audience, and you bring in what seemingly sounds like simple concepts we've been sharing are the million-dollar distinctions of what gets a speaker to the top or never allows them to succeed. So I think as people are listening, I hope they took tons of notes. And Brian, every time I hear you talk about this, I want to be a better speaker. So I appreciate being on the call today. This is awesome.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Brendan. And for those of you who are listening, remember, you can dramatically shorten the time it takes to become a good speaker by learning from the experts. The greatest success secret I ever learned from a man who spent 54 years studying success was learn from the experts. You'll never live long enough to figure it all out for yourself. So I hope that those people who have listened today and who are listening realize that you can learn from the experts and dramatically shorten your learning curve.
Love it.
Thank you, Brendan. I'm looking forward to our next time.
Thanks, Brian. We'll talk soon.
Have a great day. Bye-bye.